caught a glimpse of himself in the plate glass window. He was grinning. His eyes were shining. He was as eager and happy as he had ever been in his life. Chapter 13. It was a long time after he left, that warm September morning, that she was able to relax enough to drop the knife. When it clattered to the linoleum, she brought her arms down, oh so slowly, and cradled her breasts, as though they were two mangoes thumbed over in the marketplace and pushed aside. She stood that way in the little rented room with the sunshine pouring in until Guitar came home. He could not get her to speak or move, so he picked her up in his arms and carried her downstairs. He sat her on the bottom step while he went to borrow a car to drive her home. Terrible as he thought the whole business was, and repelled as he was by mindlessness in love, he could not keep the deep wave of sorrow from engulfing him as he looked at this really rather pretty woman sitting straight as a pole, holding her breasts and staring in front of her out of hollow eyes. The engine of the old car he'd borrowed roared, but Guitar spoke softly to her. "You think because he doesn't love you, that you are worthless? You think because he doesn't want you anymore that he is right? That his judgment and opinion of you are correct? If he throws you out, then you are garbage. You think he belongs to you because you want to belong to him? Hager, don't. It's a bad word, belong. Especially when you put it with somebody you love. Love shouldn't be like that. Did you ever see the way clouds love a mountain? They circle all around it. Sometimes you can't even see the mountain for the clouds. But you know what? You go up top, and what do you see? His head. The clouds never cover the head. His head pokes through because the clouds let him. They don't wrap him up. They let him keep his head up high, free, with nothing to hide him or bind him. Hear me, Hager? He spoke to her as he would to a very young child. You can't own a human being. You can't lose what you don't own. Suppose you did own him. Could you really love somebody who was absolutely nobody without you? You really want somebody like that? Somebody who falls apart when you walk out the door? You don't, do you? And neither does he. You're turning over your whole life to him. Your whole life, girl. And if it means so little to you that you can just give it away, hand it to him, then why should it mean any more to him? He can't value you more than you value yourself. He stopped. She did not move or give any sign that she had heard him. Pretty woman, he thought. Pretty little black-skinned woman who wanted to kill for love, die for love. The pride, the conceit of these doormat women amazed him. They were always women who had been spoiled children, whose whims had been taken seriously by adults, and who grew up to be the stingiest, greediest people on earth, and out of their stinginess grew their stingy little love that ate everything in sight. They could not believe or accept the fact that they were unloved. They believed that the world itself was off balance when it appeared as though they were not loved. Why did they think they were so lovable? Why did they think their brand of love was better than or even as good as anybody else's? But they did, and they loved their love so much they would kill anybody who got in its way. He looked at her again. Pretty, pretty little black girl. Pretty little black-skinned girl. What had Pilate done to her? Hadn't anybody told her the things she ought to know? He thought of his two sisters, grown women now, who could deal, and the litany of their growing up. Where's your daddy? Your mama know you out here in the street? Put something on your head. You gonna catch your death of cold? Ain't you hot? Ain't you cold? Ain't you scared you're gonna get wet? Uncross your legs. Pull up your socks. I thought you was going to the junior choir. Your slip is showing. Your hem is out. Come back in here and iron that collar. Hush your mouth. Comb your head. Get up there and make that bed. Put on the meat. Take out the trash. Vaseline, get rid of that ash. Neither Pilate nor Reba knew that Hagar was not like them, not strong enough like Pilate, nor simple enough like Reba to make up her life as they had. She needed what most colored girls needed, a chorus of mamas, grandmamas, aunts, cousins, sisters, neighbors, Sunday school teachers, best girlfriends, and what all to give her the strength life demanded of her, and the humor with which to live it. Still, he thought, to have the object of your love, worthy or not, despise you or leave you. You know what, Hagar? Everything I ever loved in my life left me. My father died when I was 4. That was the first leaving I knew and the hardest. Then my mother. There were 4 of us, and she just couldn't cut it when my father died. She ran away, just ran away. My aunt took care of us until my grandmother could get there. Then my grandmother took care of us. Then Uncle Billy came. They're both close to dead now. So it was hard for me to latch on to a woman, because I thought if I loved anything, it would die. But I did latch on once. But I guess once is all you can manage. Guitar thought about it and said, but I'd ever wanted to kill her. Him, yeah, but not her. He smiled, but Hagar wasn't looking, wasn't even listening. And when he led her out of the car into Reba's arms, her eyes were still empty. All they knew to do was love her. And since she would not speak, they brought things to please her. For the first time in life, Reba tried to win things, and also for the first time, couldn't. Except for a portable television set, which they couldn't connect because they had no electricity, Reba won nothing. No raffle ticket, no bingo, no policy slip, no clearinghouse number, no magazine sweepstakes, no. Nor any unpierced carnival balloon succumbed to her magic. It wore her down, puzzled and luckless. She dragged herself home, clutching stalks of anything that blossomed along the edges of lots and other people's gardens. These she presented to her daughter, who sat in a chair by the window or lay in bed, fingering her hair. They cooked special things for her, searched for gifts that they hoped would break the spell. Nothing helped. Pilate's lips were still, and Reba's eyes full of panic. They brought her lipstick and chocolate milk, a pink nylon sweater, and a fuchsia bed jacket. Reba even investigated the mysteries of making jello, both red and green. Hagar didn't even look at it. One day, Pilate sat down on Hagar's bed and held a compact, before her granddaughter's face. It was trimmed in a gold-like metal and had a pink plastic lid. "Look, baby. See here?" Pilot turned it all around to show it off and pressed in the catch. The lid sprang open, and Hager saw a tiny part of her face reflected in the mirror. She took the compact then and stared into the mirror for a long while. "No wonder," she said at last. "Look at that. No wonder. No wonder." Pilot was thrilled at the sound of Hager's voice. "It's yours, baby," she said. "Ain't it pretty?" "No wonder," said Hager. "No wonder." "No wonder what?" asked Pilot. "Look at how I look. I look awful. No wonder he didn't want me. I look terrible." Her voice was calm and reasonable, as though the last few days hadn't been lived through at all. "I need to get up from here and fix myself up." "No wonder." Hager threw back the bed cover and stood up. "Oh, I smell too. Mama, heat me some water. I need a bath, a long one. We got any bath salts left?" "Oh, Lord, my head. Look at that." She peered into the compact mirror again. "I look like a groundhog. Where's a comb?" Pilot called Reba, and together they flew through the house to find the comb. But when they found it, Hager couldn't get the teeth through her roped and matted hair. "Wash it," said Reba. "Wash it, and we'll comb it while it's wet." "I need shampoo then, real shampoo. I can't use Mama's soap." "I'll go get some." Reba was trembling a little. "What kind?" "Oh, any kind. And get some hair oil, Reba. Posner's and some." "Oh, never mind, just that. Mama, have you seen my..." "Oh, my God. No wonder. No wonder." Pilot pulled a piece of string from Hager's bedspread and put it in her mouth. "I'll heat up the water," she said. When Reba got back, she washed Hager's hair, brushed it, and combed it gently. "Just make me 2 braids, Reba. I'm going to have to go to the beauty shop today. Oh, and I need something to wear." Hager stood at the door of the little cardboard closet, running her hands over the shoulders of dresses. "Everything's a mess in here. A mess. All wrinkled. Water's hot. Where you want the tub?" "Bring it in here." "You think you should be taking a bath so soon?" Reba asked. "You just got up." "Hush, Reba," said Pilot. "Let the child take care of herself." "But she's been in the bed 3 days." "All the more reason." "I can't put these things on. Everything's a mess." Hager was almost in tears. Reba looked at Pilot. "I hope you're right. I don't approve of getting up too fast and jumping right in some water." "Help me with this tub and stop grumbling. All wrinkled. What am I going to wear?" "That ain't enough water to cover her feet. It'll grow when she sits down. Where's my yellow dress? The one that buttons all the way down. Somewhere in there, I reckon. Find it for me and press it, would you? I know it's a mess. Everything's a mess." Reba found and pressed the yellow dress. Pilot helped Hager bathe. Finally, a clean and clothed Hager stood before the two women and said, "I have to buy some clothes, new clothes. Everything I have is a mess." They looked at each other. "What you need?" asked Pilot. "I need everything," she said, and everything is what she got. She shopped for everything a woman could wear, from the skin out, with the money from Reba's diamond. They had 75 cents between them when Hager declared her needs, and $6 owed to them from customers. So the $2,000 two-carat diamond went to a pawn shop where Reba traded it for $30 at first, and then, accompanied by a storming pilot, she went back and got $170 more for it. Hager stuffed $200.75 into her purse and headed downtown, still whispering to herself every now and then, "No wonder." She bought a Playtex garter belt, eye Miller no-color hose, Fruit of the Loom panties, and two nylon slips, one white, one pink, one pair of Joyce Fancy Free, and one of Conbrio. Thank heaven for little Joyce heels. She carried an armful of skirts and an Evan Pecan two-piece number into the fitting room. Her little yellow dress that buttoned all the way down lay on the floor as she slipped a skirt over her head and shoulders down to her waist, but the placket would not close. She sucked in her stomach and pulled the fabric as far as possible, but the teeth of the zipper would not join. A light sheen broke out on her forehead as she huffed and puffed. She was convinced that her whole life depended on whether or not those aluminum teeth would meet. The nail of her forefinger split, and the balls of her thumbs ached as she struggled with the placket. Dampness became sweat, and her breath came in gasps. She was about to weep when the saleswoman poked her head through the curtain and said brightly, "How you doing?" But when she saw Hager's gnarled and frightened face, the smile froze. "Oh my," she said, and reached for the tag hanging from the skirt's waist. "This is a 5. Don't force it. You need, a 9 or 11, I should think. Please, don't force it. Let me see if I have that size." She waited until Hager let the plaid skirt fall down to her ankles before disappearing. Hager easily drew on the skirt the woman brought back, and without further search, said she would take it and the little two-piece Evan Picone. She bought a white blouse next and a nightgown, fawn, trimmed in seafoam. Now all she needed was makeup. The cosmetics department enfolded her in perfume, and she read hungrily the labels and the promise. "Myrurgia for primeval woman who creates for him a world of tender privacy where the only occupant is you." Mixed with Nina Ricci's L'air du Temps, Yardley's Flair, with Touvache's Nectarama, Dorsey's Intoxication, Robert Piguet's Fracas, and Calypso, and Visa, and Bandon, Oubigon Chantelet, Charon's Fleur de Rocaille, and Belogia. Hager breathed deeply the sweet air that hung over the glass counters. Like a smiling sleepwalker, she circled round and round the diamond clear counters, covered with bottles, wafer-thin discs, round boxes, tubes, and files. Lipsticks in soft white hands darted out of their sheets like shiny red penises of puppies. Peachy powders and milky lotions were grouped in front of poster after cardboard poster of gorgeous, grinning faces. Faces in ecstasy. Faces somber with achieved seduction. Hager believed she could spend her life there, among the cut glass, shimmering in peaches and cream, in satin, in opulence, in looks, in love. It was 5:30 when Hager left the store with two shopping bags full of smaller bags gripped in her hands. And she didn't put them down until she reached Lily's beauty parlor. "No more heads, honey," Lily looked up from the sink as Hager came in. Hager stared. "I've got to get my hair done. I have to hurry," she said. Lily looked over at Marceline. It was Marceline who kept the shop prosperous. She was younger, more recently trained, and could do a light press that lasted. Lily was still using red hot irons and an ounce of oil on every head. Her customers were loyal, but dissatisfied. Now she spoke to Marceline. "Can you take her?" "I can't, I know." Marceline peered deeply into her customer's scalp. "Hadn't planned on any late work. I got two more coming. This is my eighth today." No one spoke. Hager stared. "Well," said Marceline, "since it's you, come on back at 8:30. Is it washed already?" Hager nodded. "Okay," said Marceline, 8:30. "But don't expect nothing fancy." "I'm surprised at you," Lily chuckled when Hager left. "You just sent two people away." "Yeah, well, I don't feel like it. But I don't want no trouble with that girl Hager. No telling what she might do. She jumped that cousin of hers. No telling what she might do to me." "That the one going with Macon Dead's boy?" Lily's customer lifted her head away from the sink. "That's her. Ought to be shamed, the two of them. Cousins. Must not be working out if she's trying to kill him. I thought he left town. Wouldn't you?" "Well, I know I don't want to truck with her. Not me. She don't bother nobody but him." "Well, Pilot then. Pilot, no, I turned her down. She wouldn't like it. They spoiled that child something awful." "Didn't you order fish from next door?" "All that hair. I hope she don't expect nothing fancy. Call him up again. I'm getting hungry." "Be just like her. No appointment. No nothing. Come in here all late and wrong and want something fancy." She probably meant to wait somewhere or go home and return to Lily's at 8:30. Yet the momentum of the thing held her. It was all of a piece. From the moment she looked into the mirror in the little pink compact, she could not stop. It was as though she held her breath and could not let it go until the energy and busyness culminated in a beauty that would dazzle him. That was why, when she left Lily's, she looked neither right nor left, but walked on and on, oblivious of other people, streetlights, automobiles, and a thunderous sky. She was thoroughly soaked before she realized it was raining, and then only because one of the shopping bags split. When she looked down, her Evan Picon white with a band of color skirt was lying in a neat half-fold on the shoulder of the road, and she was far, far from home. She put down both bags, picked the skirt up, and brushed away the crumbs of gravel that stuck to it. Quickly she refolded it, but when she tried to tuck it back into the shopping bag, the bag collapsed altogether. Rain soaked her hair and poured down her neck as she stooped to repair the damage. She pulled out the box of Conbrios, a smaller package of Van Ralty gloves, and another containing her fawn-trimmed in seafoam shorty nightgown. These she stuffed into the other bag. Retracing her steps, she found herself unable to carry the heavier bag in one hand, so she hoisted it up to her stomach and hugged it with both arms. She had gone hardly 10 yards when the bottom fell out of it. Hager tripped on Jungle Red, Sculptura, and Youth Blend, and to her great dismay, saw her box of Sunny Glow toppling into a puddle. She collected Jungle Red and Youth Blend safely, but Sunny Glow, which had tipped completely over and lost its protective disc, exploded in light peach puffs under the weight of the raindrops. Hager scraped up as much of it as she could and pressed the wilted cellophane disc back into the box. Twice, before she got to Darling Street, she had to stop to retrieve her purchases from the ground. Finally, she stood in Pilot's doorway, limp, wet, and confused, clutching her bundles in whatever way she could. Reba was so relieved to see her that she grabbed her, knocking Chantilly and Bandit to the floor. Hager stiffened and pulled away from her mother. "I have to hurry," she whispered. "I have to hurry." Loafers sluicing, hair dripping, holding her purchases in her arms, she made it into the bedroom and shut the door. Pilot and Reba made no move to follow her. Hager stripped herself naked there, and without taking time to dry her face or hair or feet, she dressed herself up in the white with the band of colors skirt and matching bolero. The maiden form brassiere, the fruit of the loom panties, the no-color hose, the playtex garter belt, and the Joyce Conbrios. Then she sat down to attend to her face. She drew charcoal gray for the young round eye through her brows, after which she rubbed Mango Tango on her cheeks. Then she patted Sunny Glow all over her face. Mango Tango disappeared under it, and she had to put it on again. She pushed out her lips and spread Jungle Red over them. She put Baby Clear Skylight to outwit the daylight on her eyelids and touched Bandit to her throat, earlobes, and wrists. Finally, she poured a little Youth Blend into her palm and smoothed it over her face. At last, she opened the door and presented herself to Pilot and Reba, and it was in their eyes that she saw what she had not seen before in the mirror. The wet, ripped hose, the soiled white dress, the sticky, lumpy face powder, the streaked rouge, and the wild, wet shoals of hair. All this she saw in their eyes, and the sight filled her own with water warmer and much older than the rain. Water that lasted for hours until the fever came, and then it stopped. The fever dried her eyes up as well as her mouth. She lay in her little Goldilocks choice bed, her eyes sand dry and as quiet as glass. Pilot and Reba, seated beside the bed, bent over her like two divvy-divvy trees beaten forward by a wind always blowing from the same direction. Like the trees, they offered her all they had, love murmurs and a protective shade. "Mama?" Hager floated up into an even higher fever. "Hmm? Why don't he like my hair? Who, baby? Who don't like your hair? Milkman? Milkman does too like your hair," said Reba. "No, he don't. But I can't figure out why. Why he never liked my hair. Of course he likes it. How can he not like it? He likes silky hair." Hager was murmuring so low they had to bend down to hear her. "Silky hair? Milkman? He don't like hair like mine." "Hush, Hager. Silky hair, the color of a penny. Don't talk, baby. Curly, wavy, silky hair. He don't like mine. Pilot put her hand on Hager's head and trailed her fingers through her granddaughter's soft, damp wool. How can he not love your hair? It's the same hair that grows out of his own armpits, the same hair that crawls up out his crotch, on up his stomach, all over his chest, the very same. It grows out of his nose, over his lips, and if he ever lost his razor, it would grow all over his face. It's all over his head, Hager. It's his hair, too. He got to love it. He don't love it at all. He hates it. No, he don't. He don't know what he loves. But he'll come around, honey, one of these days. How can he love himself and hate your hair? He loves silky hair. Hush, Hager. Penny-colored hair. Please, honey. And lemon-colored skin. Shh. And gray-blue eyes. Hush now. Hush. And thin nose. Hush, girl. Hush. He's never gonna like my hair. Hush. Hush. Hush, girl. Hush. The neighbors took up a collection because Pilot and Reba had spent everything getting Hager the things needed to fix herself up. It didn't amount to much, though, and it was touch and go whether she'd have a decent funeral until Ruth walked down to Sonny's shop and stared at Macon without blinking. He reached into his cash drawer and pulled out two $20 bills and put them down on the desk. Ruth didn't stretch out her hand to pick them up or even shift her feet. Macon hesitated, then wheeled around in his chair and began fiddling with the combination to his safe. Ruth waited. Macon dipped into the safe 3 separate times before Ruth unclasped her hands and reached for the money. "Thank you," she said, and marched off to Linden Chapel Funeral Home to make the fastest arrangements possible. 2 days later, halfway through the service, it seemed as though Ruth was going to be the lone member of the bereaved family there. A female quartet from Linden Baptist Church had already sung "Abide With Me." The wife of the mortician had read the condolence cards, and the minister had launched into his "Naked came ye into this life, and naked shall ye depart" sermon, which he had always believed suitable for the death of a young woman. And the winos in the vestibule who came to pay their respects to Pilate's girl, but who dared not enter, had begun to sob. When the door swung open and Pilate burst in, shouting "Mercy," as though it were a command, a young man stood up and moved toward her. She flung out her right arm and almost knocked him down. "I want mercy," she shouted, and began walking toward the coffin, shaking her head from side to side as though somebody had asked her a question, and her answer was no. Halfway up the aisle, she stopped, lifted a finger and pointed. Then slowly, although her breathing was fast and shallow, she lowered her hand to her side. It was strange, the languorous, limp hand coming to rest at her side while her breathing was coming so quick and fast. "Mercy," she said again, but she whispered it now. The mortician scurried toward her and touched her elbow. She moved away from him and went right up to the bier. She tilted her head and looked down. Her earring grazed her shoulder. Out of the total blackness of her clothes, It blazed like a star. The mortician tried to approach her again and moved closer, but when he saw her inky, berry-black lips, her cloudy, rainy eyes, the wonderful brass box hanging from her ear, he stepped back and looked at the floor. Mercy? Now she was asking a question. Mercy? It was not enough. The word needed a bottom, a frame. She straightened up, held her head high, and transformed the plea into a note. In a clear bluebell voice, she sang it out. The one word held so long, it became a sentence. And before the last syllable had died in the corners of the room, she was answered in a sweet soprano. I hear you. The people turned around. Reba had entered and was singing too. Pilate neither acknowledged her entrance nor missed a beat. She simply repeated the word, mercy. And Reba replied. The daughter standing at the back of the chapel, the mother up front. They sang. In the nighttime, mercy. In the darkness, mercy. In the morning, mercy. At my bedside, mercy. On my knees now, mercy. 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 They stopped at the same time in a high silence. Pilate reached out her hand and placed three fingers on the edge of the coffin. Now she addressed her words to the woman bordered in gray satin who lay before her. Softly, privately, she sang to Hagar the very same reassurance she had promised her when she was a little girl. Who's been bothering my sweet sugar lumpkin? Who's been bothering my baby? Who's been bothering my sweet sugar lumpkin? Who's been bothering my baby girl? Somebody's been bothering my sweet sugar lumpkin. Somebody's been bothering my baby. Somebody's been bothering my sweet sugar lumpkin. Somebody's been bothering my baby girl. I'll find who's bothering my sweet sugar lumpkin. I'll find who's bothering my baby. I'll find who's bothering my sweet sugar lumpkin. I'll find who's bothering my baby girl. My baby girl. The three words were still pumping in her throat as she turned away from the coffin, looking about at the faces of the people seated in the pews. She fastened on the first pair of eyes that were directed toward her. She nodded at the face and said, "My baby girl." She looked for another pair of eyes and told him also, "My baby girl." Moving back down the aisle, she told each face turned toward her the same piece of news, "My baby girl." "That's my baby girl. My baby girl. My baby girl. My baby girl." Conversationally, she spoke, identifying Hagar, selecting her away from everybody else in the world who had died. First, she spoke to the ones who had the courage to look at her, shake their heads, and say, "Amen." Then she spoke to those whose nerve failed them, whose glance would climb no higher than the long black fingers at her side. Toward them especially, she leaned a little, telling in three words the full story of the stumped life in the coffin behind her. "My baby girl." Words tossed like stones into a silent canyon. Suddenly, like an elephant who has just found his anger and lifts his trunk over the heads of the little men who want his teeth, or his hide, or his flesh, or his amazing strength. Pilate trumpeted for the sky itself to hear. And she was loved. It startled one of the sympathetic winos in the vestibule, and he dropped his bottle, spurting emerald glass and jungle red wine everywhere. Chapter 14. Perhaps it was because the sun had hit the rim of the horizon, but Susan Bird's house looked different. The cedar tree was a silvery gray, and its bark crinkled all the way up. It looked to Milkman like the leg of an ancient elephant. And now he noticed that the ropes that held the swing were frayed, and the picket fence that had looked so bright and perky before was really flaked, peeling, even leaning to the left. The blue steps leading to the porch were faded into a watery gray. In fact, the whole house looked seedy. He lifted his hand to knock on the door and noticed the doorbell. He rang it, and Susan Bird opened the door. "Hello again," he said. "Well," she said, "you're as good as your word. I'd like to talk to you some more, if you don't mind, about Sing. May I come in?" "Of course." She stood back from the door, and the odor of another batch of gingerbread wafted out. Again, they sat in the living room, he in the gray wingback chair, she on the sofa this time. Miss Long was nowhere in sight. "I know you don't know who Sing married, or if she married, but I was wondering, of course I know who she married. That is, if they did marry. She married Jake, that black boy her mother took care of." Milkman felt dizzy. Everybody kept changing right in front of him. "But yesterday, you said nobody heard from her after she left." "Nobody did. But they knew who she left with." "Jake?" "Jake. Black Jake. Black as coal." Where did they live? Boston?" "I don't know where they ended up. North, I guess. We never heard." "I thought you said she went to a private school in Boston." She dismissed the whole notion with a wave of her hand. "I just said that in front of her, Grace. She talks so much, you know. Carries tales all over the county. It's true she was supposed to go to some school, but she didn't. She left on that double-team wagon with that black boy, Jake. A whole lot of slaves got together. Jake was driving. Can you imagine it? Riding off with a wagon load of slaves?" "What was Jake's last name? Can you tell me?" She shrugged. "I don't think he had one. He was one of those flying African children. They must all be dead a long time now." "Flying African children?" "Mm-hmm. One of Solomon's children, or Shalimar. Papa said Hetty always called him Shalimar. And Hetty was my grandmother, Sing's mother and Papa's too. An Indian woman. She was the one took care of Jake when his father left them all. She found him, took him home, and raised him. She didn't have any boy children then. My father, Kroll, came later." She leaned forward and whispered, "She didn't have a husband, Hetty." "I don't want to go into all that with Grace. You can imagine what she'd do with that information." "You're a stranger, so it doesn't matter. But Grace," Susan Bird looked pleadingly at the ceiling. "This Jake was a baby she found, and he and Sing grew up together, And I guess rather than be packed off to some Quaker school, she ran away with him. You know, colored people and Indians mixed a lot, but sometimes, well, some Indians didn't like it. The marrying, I mean. But neither one of them knew their own father, Jake or Singh. And my own father didn't know his. Hetty never said. I don't know to this day if he was white, red, or, well, what. Singh's name was Singing Bird, and my father's name was Crow at first. Later he changed it to Crowell Bird, after he took off his buckskin, she smiled. Why did you call Solomon a flying African? Oh, that's just some old folks' lie they tell around here. Some of those Africans they brought over here as slaves could fly. A lot of them flew back to Africa. The one around here who did was this same Solomon, or Shalimar, I never knew which was right. He had a slew of children all over the place. You may have noticed that everybody around here claims kin to him. Must be over 40 families spread in these hills, calling themselves Solomon something or other. I guess he must have been hot stuff, she laughed. But anyway, hot stuff or not, he disappeared and left everybody, wife, everybody, including some 21 children. And they say they all saw him go. The wife saw him, and the children saw him. They were all working in the fields. They used to try to grow cotton here. Can you imagine, in these hills? But cotton was king then. Everybody grew it until the land went bad. It was cotton even when I was a girl. Well, back to this Jake boy. He was supposed to be one of Solomon's original 21. All boys, and all of them with the same mother. Jake was the baby. The baby and the wife were right next to him when he flew off. When you say flew off, you mean he ran away, don't you? Escaped? No, I mean flew. Oh, it's just foolishness, you know. But according to the story, he wasn't running away. He was flying. He flew, you know, like a bird, just stood up in the fields one day, ran up some hill, spun around a couple of times, and was lifted up in the air. Went right on back to wherever it was he came from. There's a big, double-headed rock over the valley named for him. He'd like to kill the woman, the wife. I guess you could say wife. Anyway, she's supposed to have screamed out loud for days. And there's a ravine near here they call Rhina's Gulch. And sometimes you can hear this funny sound by it that the wind makes. People say it's the wife, Solomon's wife, crying. Her name was Rhina. They say she screamed and screamed, lost her mind completely. You don't hear about women like that anymore, but there used to be more. The kind of woman who couldn't live without a particular man, and when the man left, they lost their minds or died or something. Love, I guess. But I always thought it was trying to take care of children by themselves, you know what I mean? She talked on, and while Milkman sat back and listened to gossip, stories, legends, speculations, his mind was ahead of hers, behind hers, with hers, and bit by bit, with what she said, what he knew, and what he guessed, he put it all together. Singh has said she was going to a Quaker school, but she joined Jake on his wagon full of ex-slaves heading for Boston or somewhere. They must have dropped their passengers all along the way. And then Jake, at the reins, took a wrong turn because he couldn't read, and they ended up in Pennsylvania. But there's a children's game they play around here. And in the game, they sing Jake, the only son of Solomon. Only. He looked at her, hoping she wouldn't mind the interruption. Well, they're wrong. He wasn't the only son. There were 20 others. But he was the only one Solomon tried to take with him. Maybe that's what it means. He lifted him up, but dropped him near the porch of the big house. That's where Hetty found him. She used to come over there and help with the soap making and the candle making. She wasn't a slave, but she worked over at the big house certain times of year. She was melting tallow when she looked up and saw this man holding a baby and flying toward the ridge. He brushed too close to a tree, and the baby slipped out of his arms and fell through the branches to the ground. He was unconscious, but the trees saved him from dying. Hetty ran over and picked him up. She didn't have any male children, like I said, just a little bitty girl, and this one just dropped out of the sky, almost in her lap. She never named him anything different. She was afraid to do that. She found out the baby was Rhina's, but Rhina was out of her mind. Hetty lived a good ways off from the place Solomon and them others worked on. She tried to keep the girl away from that place, too, and you could imagine how she felt when both of them ran off. Just my father was left. Did Jake have to register at the Freedmen's Bureau before he left the state? Everybody did. Everybody who had been slaves, that is, whether they left the state or not. But we were never slaves. So, you told me that. Weren't any of Jake's brothers registering too? I couldn't say. Those must have been some times back then. Some bad times. It's a wonder anybody knows who anybody is. You've helped me a lot, Miss Bird. I'm grateful. He thought then about asking her if she had a photo album. He wanted to see Sing, Kroll, and even Hetty. But he decided against it. She might start asking him questions. And he didn't want to trouble her with a newfound relative who was as black as Jake. Now, that's not the woman you're looking for, is it? Pilot? No, he said. Couldn't be. He made motions of departure and then remembered his watch. By the way, did I leave my watch here? I'd like it back. Watch? Yes. Your friend wanted to see it. Miss Long. I handed it to her, but I forgot. Milkman stopped. Susan Bird was laughing out loud. Well, you can say goodbye to it, Mr. Macon. Grace will go to dinner all over the county, telling people about the watch you gave her. What? Well, you know, she doesn't mean any real harm, but it's a quiet place. We don't have many visitors, especially young men who wear gold watches and have northern accents. I'll get it back for you. Never mind. Never mind. You'll just have to forgive her otherwise. This is a dull place, Mr. Macon. There's absolutely nothing in the world going on here. Not a thing. Chapter 15. The fan belt didn't last long enough for him to get to the next gasoline station. It broke on the edge of a little town called Jistan, the needle trembling at H. Milkman sold it to the tow truck man for $20 and caught the first bus out. It was probably best that way, for over the humming wheels, his legs folded in the little space in front of his seat, he had time to come down from the incredible high that had begun as soon as he slammed the Bird Woman's door. He couldn't get back to Shalimar fast enough. and when he did get there, dusty and dirty from the run, he leaped into the car and drove to Sweet's house. He almost broke her door down. "I want to swim," he shouted. "Come on, let's go swimming. I'm dirty and I want water." Sweet smiled and said she'd give him a bath. "Bath? You think I'd put myself in that tight little porcelain box? I need the sea, the whole goddamn sea." Laughing, hollering, he ran over to her and picked her up at the knees and ran around the room with her over his shoulder. "The sea. I have to swim in the sea. Don't give me no itty-bitty teeny-tiny tub, girl. I need the whole entire complete deep blue sea." He stood her on her feet. "Don't you all swim around here?" "Over at the quarry is where the kids go sometimes." "Quarry? You all don't have no sea? No ocean?" "No, this is hill country." "Hill country, mountain country, flying country. A man was here to see you." "Oh, yeah. That would be Mr. Guitar Baines. He didn't give his name." "He don't have to. He's Guitar Baines. Guitar, guitar, Guitar Baines." Milkman did a little dance, and Sweet covered her mouth, laughing. "Come on, Sweet. Tell me where the sea is." "There's some water coming down below the ridge on the other side. Real deep. Wide, too. Then let's go. Come on." He grabbed her arm and pulled her out to the car. He sang all the way. "Solomon and Rhina, Bilali, Shalute." "Where you learn that?" she asked him. "That's a game we used to play when we was little." "Of course you did. Everybody did. Everybody but me. But I can play it now. It's my game now." The river in the valley was wide and green. Milkman took off his clothes, climbed a tree, and dived into the water. He surfaced like a bullet, iridescent, grinning, splashing water. "Come on, take them clothes off, and come on in here." "No, I don't want to swim. Come in here, girl." "Water moccasins in there. Fuck them. Get in here. Hurry up." She stepped out of her shoes, pulled her dress over her head, and was ready. Milkman reached up for her as she came timidly down the bank, slipping, stumbling, laughing at her own awkwardness, then squealing as the cold river water danced up her legs, her hips, her waist. Milkman pulled her close and kissed her mouth, ending the kiss with a determined effort to pull her under the water. She fought him. "Oh, my hair. My hair's going to get wet." "No, it ain't," he said, and poured a handful right in the middle of her scalp. Wiping her eyes, spluttering water, she turned to wade out, shrieking all the way. "Okay, okay," he bellowed. "Leave me. Leave me in here all by myself. I don't care. I'll play with the water moccasins." And he began to whoop and dive and splash and turn. He could fly, you hear me? My great-granddaddy could fly. Goddamn. He whipped the water with his fists, then jumped straight up as though he too could take off, and landed on his back and sank down, his mouth and eyes full of water. Up again, still pounding, leaping, diving. The son of a bitch could fly. You hear me, Sweet? That motherfucker could fly. Could fly. He didn't need no airplane. Didn't need no fucking TWA. He could fly his own self. "Who you talking about?" Sweet was lying on her side, her cheek cupped in her hand. "Solomon, that's who." "Oh, him," she laughed. "You belong to that tribe of niggers?" She thought he was drunk. "Yeah, that tribe. That flying motherfucking tribe. Oh, man, he didn't need no airplane. He just took off. Got fed up. All the way up. No more cotton, No more bails, no more orders, no more shit. He flew away, baby. Lift his beautiful black ass up in the sky and flew on home. Can you dig it? Jesus God,